It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Madison School District fired an African-American security guard for using a racial slur in the process of telling a student to stop calling him that word. We'll learn about the controversy surrounding the move. First, cooking can look complicated, especially when you're just starting out or branching out into something new. It always feels like there can be so many variables that go into a good meal. And it might feel like sticking to a recipe is the tried and true safe way to make something taste good. But our next guest says that discovering the secrets of four components of cooking can not only make you a better cook, but also help you gain the confidence to experiment more in the kitchen. Those components? Salt, fat, acid, and heat. Samin Nosrat is a chef and author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, Mastering the Elements of Good Cooking. She's the host of the Netflix series of the same name. She'll be in Madison this upcoming Wednesday at the Overture Center and joins us now in this week's edition of Food Friday. Samin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, you start at an even more basic element than those four elements. You write, anyone can cook anything and make it delicious. That's a pretty inspiring message.
I do believe it. I really think that, you know, we're all born with taste buds and the senses, and we, you know, using them is really the way to become a better cook. And there's so much in the world that sort of sends us these messages that we need all of this complicated stuff or follow complicated recipes. But from everything that I've seen, it really works to just practice and taste.
And you followed such an interesting path into cooking. You started off as a normal non-chef like any of us and kind of found your way into this. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So I grew up, my mom is an amazing cook. My family's from Iran. So I grew up eating really delicious home-cooked food, but I didn't really have much interest in cooking. You know, I loved eating. And I do think that's an important prerequisite for anyone who wants to be a cook. But it wasn't until I moved from San Diego, where I grew up, to Berkeley for college and found out about a restaurant called Chez Panisse, that I sort of even had any interest in cooking. And even then, it came much later. My boyfriend and I, when I was in college, saved up for 7 months. We saved $220 to go eat at Chez Panisse, which is really sort of one of the temples of American fine dining. It was started in the 70s by Alice Waters, who is sort of the godmother of local seasonal organic cooking. And at the time, I didn't know anything about any of that. I just knew it was a nice restaurant to go to. And so we went and had this dinner, which was really nice and by all means delicious. And, you know, I grew up eating delicious food, so I appreciated it. But what I really appreciated was how eating in a restaurant could feel so much like eating in someone's home and being so taken care of. And every detail was so carefully thought through. And it was just so charming and inspiring that I wrote a letter asking for a job bussing tables. And when I brought it in, they hired me and asked me if I would start the next day, which now, as a person who's run restaurants, I understand that was just a sign of desperation because I had no qualifications. But I was an English major who, you know, didn't really know what I was going to do after I graduated college. And here I was in this incredible world-class restaurant, walking through this kitchen, watching chefs turn ingredients into the most delicious meals I'd ever had. And they were doing it so beautifully. And it was just, it was like a symphony. And I wanted to be part of that. So I begged them to teach me.
Talking to Samin Nosrat, author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. She's gone from bussing tables to a chef and cooking instructor, author, host of a Netflix show. Samin, let's get into these elements now, the four pillars of your book here. And I'm kind of a negative person, I guess. The more I think about your four-part formulation and I think back to foods that I've made that were okay but not great, it was because I did one of those four things wrong almost all the time. Like, this is a handy diagnostic for what's going wrong in our cooking.
Yeah, I mean, and you can use it while you're cooking to get on the right track. But should we start with salt?
Let's start with salt. And we could spend hours probably just talking about what you wrote about salt in your book. One thing that I loved that you talked about, it isn't always just like too little salt or too much salt, but when you put in the salt.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think in general, most people could benefit from a little more salt in their food. But I don't think that that's always the answer. I think when you add it is really important, because if you think about it, you know, the simplest way to think about it is, say, if you're roasting a chicken and if you sprinkle it with salt right before you put it in the oven, the salt doesn't have the time to travel anywhere. So it all just stays on the skin, so that you get this like delicious, salty, crispy skin. And then you take a bite of the meat and it's bland and dry. And so if you, on the other hand, if you add the salt the day before, you give the salt the time it needs to travel all throughout the bird and really be distributed evenly throughout the meat. And besides seasoning it and making it much more flavorful, it also affects the texture of the meat, and you end up with much more tender meat. And I can always tell now, like I can always tell meat that hasn't been salted in advance just from the first bite.
Does it the same rule always apply? Do we salt at different times for, I don't know, a soup or a fish dish or different things?
Yeah, different things absolutely really need to be salted at different times. Meat in general really benefits from a day's head start. Fish is much more delicate, so really just 5 minutes or 20 minutes is, at the most, is plenty. And then with things like soup and vegetables, you know, I'm big on tossing my vegetables with oil and salt before I roast them in the oven, because same thing, they're just smaller, so the salt doesn't take as long to travel through. But you really want to get that thing salted throughout. A pot of water that you're going to cook vegetables in should be really heavily salted before you put the vegetables in. But for dishes like soups and stews, I salt as I go, because the flavor changes over time. And you can absolutely fix a soup at the end, you know, and just get it perfectly seasoned, but it's a lot nicer and a lot less sort of jarring to do it all throughout, because salt also affects the way everything else tastes, the way the spices taste and the way the acid tastes. And so it's kind of like you're fixing everything a little bit at a time. You know, you don't want to just have to do one big change sort of at the end.
I'm kind of a boring guy in my salt game. I use your basic table salt. I got a little kosher, you know, the chunky kosher salt for a little of this and that. What's one creative kind of salt out there that you recommend people try to expand their salt palate?
Yeah, I think, you know, something I really like is flaky salts, that are flaky sea salts that have been sort of evaporated over the course of many days. And what happens is they turn into these really delightful and honestly quite extraordinary pyramid shapes. And there's Malden salt, which comes from England. And then here domestically, there's a really lovely salt called Jacobson sea salt from Oregon. And the purpose of having these like really flaky light pyramids is that when they get, you know, they end up on your tongue and you bite down on them, they're so light that they're kind of it's kind of like biting into a teeny tiny potato chip or something. They're crisp and light, and the saltiness explodes on your tongue, and it's this really wonderful burst of saltiness. And so that's probably, if you've ever had like a fancy chocolate chip cookie or brownie that's had salt sprinkled on top, it's probably that stuff that has made its way onto there. And it really does make a difference. It can be expensive. It can be anywhere from like $6 to $10 for a little box of it. But you have to remember, it's the stuff you sprinkle, you're just using a little pinch. So for me, a box of that lasts, you know, over a year.
We're talking to Samin Nosrat, chef and author of the book Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, Mastering the Elements of Good Cooking. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have for Samin about her cooking philosophy, how to use these four elements, the salt, the fat, the acid, the heat? Did you make a discovery that really upped your cooking game in one of those four fields? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation with Samin Nosrat, chef and author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, Mastering the Elements of Good Cooking. You can join in if you have a question for Samin at 800-642-1234. Do you need some advice on using heat, acid, fat, or salt? Have you taken advice from her book or her Netflix series and used it in your own cooking directly or as inspiration? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Samin, we got an email from Kristen who says, I'm a professional chef and your book and show are highly inspirational for me. I love your positivity. And Kristen writes, I've noticed your efforts to feature women and people of color in your work. Do you have any recommendations for cookbooks or chef's work I may not have heard of?
Oh, sure. I love this question. I really love, there's a young woman writing these days about Indian cooking and all sorts of other cooking named Priya Krishna, who I think is so funny. She writes in The New Yorker and The New York Times and for Bon Appetit. I really love her, and her book is called Indian-ish. There's this other book that I love. I'm struggling to remember the name. Well, one really important person who I do think we as American are all responsible to have a relationship to is Edna Lewis, who often gets described with the shorthand description of the Black Julia Child. But in a lot of ways, I think that does a disservice to both Ms. Lewis and Ms. Child, because they were really their own people. And Edna Lewis, in a lot of ways, is the single most important and influential figure in American regional cooking. I mean, she took Southern food and was one of the first people to really dedicate, you know, and get it down on the page. And her writing, she has several books, and she is just, she's an incredible figure who I like to do a lot of work to sort of spread the gospel of.
Thanks a lot for that email. We spent some time on salt. I want to touch on at least a couple of the other parts of your quartet there. How about acid? And this is something I've been discovering lately. If I'm cooking something and I feel like it needs something, like 90% of the time, it's some kind of acid. Can you talk about the role of and the kinds of acid we use?
I'm so glad you chose acid to ask about, because I think it's, in some ways, it has the most clinical name of the four. And so a lot of people feel a little bit intimidated by it. And it's not a word that, you know, most home cooks are used to using, because we talk instead about things like lemon juice or vinegar or tomatoes instead. But all acid is anything that's got a tang to it. It's sour. And where salt, you know, the function that salt plays in our cooking is really to enhance flavors. Acid brings contrast and balances flavors. So it's exactly what you said. You know, like I recently was at a friend's house and she was making a chicken pot pie, and she had the filling ready to go. And she was like, it just needs something. And I don't know what, because it's definitely salty enough. And I tasted and I said, oh, you know, if you just add a spoonful or two of white wine, that'll perk this up and bring it to life. And so we all naturally want that. We have those acidic taste buds, and we all already actually are drawn toward acidic things. You know, it's like when you take a bite of a burrito and it needs something, usually you add salsa or sour cream or cheese. And all of those things are sources of acid, because that's what brings it to life.
A lot of times as I'm cooking, my acids of choice are red wine vinegar or lime or lemon. What's the right way to pair a particular acid with the thing we're cooking? How do we know which is the right one to reach for?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I really try to sort of look back to tradition and geography to let that direct me in my cooking. And so just last night I was making some Cuban black beans. And I was like, this needs a little something. What am I going to do? and I didn't have sort of the regular kind of white vinegar that I thought that would be used in that dish. So instead, I used hot sauce. I had some Cuban hot sauce, so I used that. So I try to always think about what's available in the region where I'm inspired by. So if it's, you know, Japanese cooking, I'll use rice vinegar. If I'm cooking food from, you know, Germany, I'll use apple cider vinegar or wine vinegar. In France and Italy, it's always wine vinegars and lemon. They love lemon. But there are parts of the world where citrus doesn't grow. So if there's not citrus there, I would rely more on vinegar and try and use the vinegar that comes from the source that makes sense in that place. And as a person who travels a lot, my fridge is like mostly devoid of actual staples and filled instead with a lot of condiments and things like pickles and kimchi and fermented things. And so those things from all over the world are what allow me to take a pot of beans or a pot of rice or a simple chicken broth and really sort of tinker with it and get it to taste right from the right part of the world, is having all of those acids and condiments on hand.
And that reminds me of something I loved in your book, and I've got it flipped open now. You've got these flip-out pages with these circle charts where you have regions of the world, and then you break it down by country, and then you've got whatever it is, the fats or the acids, depending on the chart, that go along with it.
Yeah, and it's the whole idea of salt, fat, acid, heat really is that it is such a universal philosophy, and that everywhere I go in the world, I see people cooking this way and using this mnemonic device, whether or not they can articulate it, to guide them through their cooking. And so it was sort of a way for me to prove that by making these maps of the world and saying like, oh, these are the acids, these are the salts, these are the fats, these are what people use to make their food taste good. And if you want it to, if you're making a stew, the method you use to make the stew is pretty much the same wherever you go. The ingredients just change and the flavorings change.
Talking to Samin Nosrat, chef and author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. It's this week's edition of Food Friday. Got an email from Janine who says, hey, any suggestions for people who can't have salt or on low sodium diets? This speaks to me. My dad was on a low sodium diet growing up, and that was a challenge for cooking. Any advice, Samin, to help work around that?
Yeah. So, like I said, like we discussed, I think a lot of the time, when you add the salt makes a big difference. So especially for me, even if you're reducing it, doing it earlier makes a big difference. The other beauty is our palates are really malleable. And for example, my mom, when I was growing up, she didn't use a lot of salt. And I didn't have anything to compare that to. So everything tasted really fantastic and totally flavorful. And then once I got used to more salt, I could then sense the blandness. So once you, if you commit to a low salt diet, your palate will adjust to really get used to that. And then you can use all of the incredible sources of acid and certainly the spices of the world. And another thing that's really important for me to make food taste good is fresh herbs. So I really try to use the fresh herb that's appropriate for the place and just use that at the last minute to bring anything to life, even if it's like really old leftovers.
Well, let's spend some time on heat. And this is not like heat as in hot peppers, but this is the thermal part of cooking, heating stuff up. And I think when I, if you boil a carrot or you oven roast it or cooking in different ways, it's almost like, is this even the same starting food? Can you talk about the miracle of heat and how it transforms what we're cooking?
Yeah. So the beautiful thing about heat, like we discussed, I didn't come from a formal cooking background. And so there's just so much language when it comes to cooking techniques that I had no idea what people were talking about braising versus stewing and roasting and pan roasting. And, the kitchen where I worked, it was a professional kitchen. And sometimes we'd do something on the stove. And if we were out of stove room, they'd say, oh, build a fire and cook it over that. And these kinds of things seemed completely like incomprehensible to me, how to make sense of all of these different forms of heat and how to get the same result. But over time, I saw sort of two important things that I think really made everything a lot more clear. One is that it doesn't really matter what your source of heat is, whether you're cooking something over a campfire or out on a grill or on the stove or in the oven. What's much more relevant and important is what's happening to your food and the rate at which it's happening. So if I'm browning a steak over a hot grill, but it's now wintertime and I can't go outside, and if I want to achieve that same result and get that same crispy exterior, then I want to get my cooking surface really, really hot. So I'll use a cast iron pan and I'll preheat it in the oven until it's like blazing hot, and then I'll put it on the stove over the highest heat and sear my steak so that I'm getting that same thing on the outside. I'm getting that seared crust. That's the important thing, not the source of heat. And the other thing that was really sort of a really helpful tool for me was to realize, again, that all around the world, people sort of rely on two levels of heat. They're not, you know, in the most sort of like rural places or sort of our most historical cooking techniques don't rely on precision. And ovens actually are some of the least precise cooking tools we have. Because you might put the dial at 375, but what's happening in the oven is probably not 375 for much longer than 30 seconds. So it's more like, do I want my food to be simmering and cooking slowly and sort of absorbing water and gently becoming tender? Or do I want my food to immediately get brown on the outside and cook very quickly? So I kind of think about it in terms of, am I cooking something tender that I want to keep tender? In which case I would use high heat to sear a piece of fish or a steak. Or do I want to take something that's tough and make it tender? Like, I don't know, braised oxtails. That's something that is tough and needs to grow tender. Or, dried beans. Those are things that need to simmer over low heat for a very long period of time. And again, it doesn't matter what the source of heat is. It matters the rate at which you cook it.
Well, we're going to have to leave fat aside for now. We won't in our cooking. But Samin, you're going to be talking in Wisconsin next week. Give us a quick taste of what you'll be talking about.
Well, I really spend a lot of time in these conversations thinking and talking about community and how we can use food to really grow closer to one another and take care of each other and take care of our earth. But I'll be joined in Madison by my friend Abra Behrens, who is a really wonderful chef. And she and I spend a lot of our time thinking and talking about sustainability and the environment and the role of food in that. So I'm sure we'll talk about that too.
Samin, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for having me.
That's Samin Nosrat, chef and author of Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, Mastering the Elements of Good Cooking. She's also the host of the Netflix series of the same name. She joined us for this week's edition of Food Friday. She'll be in Madison this upcoming Wednesday, October 23rd at the Overture Center. We have a link to that event at WPR.org. Coming up after the news, students walked out in protest today over the firing of an African-American security guard who told a student to stop calling him the N-word. That was at a Wisconsin school. The story's gone nationwide. We'll get the details from a reporter following that story. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, new preliminary jobs numbers show what could be worrying signs about the state's manufacturing industry. We'll break it all down with an economist from UW-Madison. First, students walked out of Madison West High School today to protest the firing of an African-American security guard from the school. Marlon Anderson was fired from his job following an alleged incident with a student last week. According to Anderson, he used the N-word after a student had repeatedly used the same slur against him. Anderson says he used the word to tell the student not to use that word to describe him. But the district's zero-tolerance policy meant that Anderson's use of the N-word, regardless of context, became the grounds for dismissal. Since then, a grievance has been filed against the school. Scott Gerard is the local K-12 education reporter at the Cap Times. He's been following the story. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, I laid out the very basics. Can you flesh out the details of that initial incident for us?
Yeah. So a student was being escorted from what we understand. A student was being escorted by an assistant principal and was just continuing to yell. And Marlon Anderson tried to intervene to help the student and help calm the student down. And at that point, the student started using the slur toward Marlon. Marlon, according to his report, said, "Don't call me that. Don't use that word. Don't call me," and then did say the word. And as you mentioned, the zero tolerance practice, which went into place last year after a series of incidents involving the N-word used by staff members, meant that the district fired him.
There's been a big response since then, locally, statewide, and even national news outlets now covering it. Can you talk about the response, though, from students at the school in particular?
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Students came out very strong today. There were, I think, over 1,000 there. The concourse and the stairs at the school filled up quickly after second hour when the walkout was planned for. All of them marched the 40 minutes or so to the Doyle Building. Many of them stayed for quite a while marching around the Doyle Building as Black student union members met with officials from the district, the interim superintendent, and a couple board members inside the building. Marlon's son, Noah, is actually a senior at the high school and is the president of the Black Student Union. And that union organized the walkout and has been organizing a lot of the follow-up events. Yesterday, there was a session at the Black Student Union's weekly meeting where district officials came in and talked to them and heard from students. So they've been doing a lot of that organizing, and Noah has really been at the forefront of that as well.
What has the district itself been saying about the firing and the response to it?
A lot of their statements have said, there's a process that's playing out. The grievance has been filed, and they'll allow that to play out as it normally would. They did mention today, both Board President Gloria Reyes and Interim Superintendent Jane Belmore talked about how that process can play out. There will be an independent hearing officer who will hear both sides and come to a decision. Gloria Reyes said she hopes to see an expedited process with that this time around. That hearing officer's decision can also be appealed to the school board, which could overturn or sustain it. So this could get to the school board. It's hard to say exactly what that timeline will be. It normally can be a long process, but I think given the public attention here, it likely will be a little quicker than normal.
Now, Marlon Anderson himself talked to Madison's Channel 3 News, Madeline O'Neill, about why he felt the need to stand up and ask the student not to call him the N-word. Here's some of what he had to say.
My father was called this word. My grandmother, my grandfather. And keep going on down the family line. We were all called this word, and not one of them could say, don't call me that. I can't. And I shouldn't be punished because I have the right to tell somebody not to call me this word.
Marlon Anderson there talking to Channel 3 News. This story, I think people are upset about it because it's very different than the stories where teachers had apparently called students that the N-word. Is context being taken into account in this story?
So it's not given the zero tolerance policy, but I think that's where a lot of the student pushback and staff pushback, frankly, there were also more than a couple dozen staff members who walked from West to the administration building in support of Marlon and students today. And what I heard in talking to them is that context does matter. The race of the person using the word matters. Whether they're calling someone the word or telling someone not to use it matters. The race of the person hearing the word, or the, I guess, on the other side of that also matters. That was really something I heard from a lot of people today. One staff member at West, who said he's known Marlon for a decade or so, said, the history of the N-word, a zero tolerance policy, isn't going to erase it overnight from our country. And so context needs to be taken into account. And what Marlon was trying to do, they say, is educate this student on why not to use it. And that opportunity needs to be taken advantage of.
Scott Gerard is with us from the Cap Times, looking at a Madison story that's getting national attention. A security guard, African-American security guard, fired for the use of the N-word, but using it to tell a student not to call him that word. National attention, as I've mentioned a couple times, Scott. New York Times covering this. Cher weighing in online, offering to cover Marlon Anderson's legal defense. This is not just a local story anymore.
No, certainly not. I think it really fits into a national narrative about inequities and racial challenges in a lot of communities. And Madison certainly has experienced those. You look back at the Race to Equity report, that's been here for a while. And the district, over the years, a few years ago, said zero tolerance wasn't right for student discipline. And so they've been spending a lot of time on figuring out behavior plans for students and how to handle their discipline. And so I think this is kind of entering a similar discussion time, is how do we move from zero tolerance to something that takes context into effect?
Right. Is that something that school board members and others have been talking about? Okay, maybe apart from this individual case, it's time to revisit that particular policy?
So after the meeting today with the Black Student Union members, the superintendent and board president did say they were open to reconsidering that practice and wanted to hear from students and the people affected by the practice. Noah Anderson, again, Marlon's son, said he felt pretty confident student voice would be a part of that conversation going forward and was pretty satisfied with how the district officials listened to them today.
Now, Marlon Anderson, as you mentioned, after being fired, he has filed a grievance. I understand the local teachers union, the division that represents people in that kind of staff position, backing him up on that. I understand there's an effort to get that expedited. This can be a long, slow process.
Yeah. So normally the process, there's actually four steps to it and different levels of who's reviewing it, starting with a building administrator. Then it goes to the director of human resources. And only then, if it were appealed, would it go to an independent hearing officer. And all of those steps can take up to a month or so with different application and response timelines. But the union requested to skip to the independent hearing officer in this case, and based on the comments today from the district officials, it sounds like the district has agreed to that. So it will go to a hearing officer, which should speed it up a little bit. What expedited means beyond that is hard to say, because there still does have to be an agreement on this hearing officer, and certainly both parties will have a lot of interest in who that officer is and their background and their history. And then they have to set a date for the hearing, and making sure that all of the necessary parties are available could take some time as well.
Now, we heard that TV interview, a bit of it, with Marlon Anderson. What else has he had to say about this whole incident?
Yeah, so he's talked to a number of different news outlets, and really he just wants context taken into account, it seems. He spoke even before the news of his firing came out with Madison 365, and shared a lot of the story there about how the history of the word plays into how he views this situation and how he really wants it to be considered that students need to understand and need a chance to hear the history of the word.
Just watching online response to this, liberals, conservatives, all points in between, progressives, whatever. A lot of people seem to agree on this story that he probably shouldn't have been fired. That seems to be a cross-partisan consensus here.
Yeah, I would say you've seen some outrage at this firing from people of many different political leanings. And it goes to some people saying the district is just being oversensitive to this word and needs to consider context, and then people on the other side also saying context matters because the race of the person saying it matters, and we need to consider those things when making these decisions.
And as we wrap up, what are you watching for next?
Yeah, I think so. It sounds like next week school board member Savion Castro is going to meet with the Black Student Union at West High School to discuss some next steps. Certainly the school board meeting at the end of the month. I would imagine there will be some people showing up there. I'm not sure if the board will discuss it directly there or not, but and past that, it'll be the timing of the hearing and what steps are next. Noah Anderson did say today that his father would go back to West if he were reinstated.
Scott, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Scott Gerard, local K-12 education reporter at the Cap Times. He joined us to talk about the controversial firing of Marlon Anderson, an African-American security guard at Madison West High School, dismissed after using the N-word in the process of asking a student not to call him that word, a story getting national attention today. Coming up, we'll check in on the state of Wisconsin's manufacturing industry as tariffs and trade tensions continue. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at some news stories from around the state, including a debate over a controversial business development in Milwaukee. First, the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics released job numbers recently. They had what could be worrying signs for Wisconsin's manufacturing industry. The figures are preliminary, but so far they show the state is losing manufacturing jobs, with August showing the biggest year-over-year decline since the last recession. But some economists say the numbers may overstate the bad news. The report comes as the latest round of tariffs on European Union goods take effect today and as tensions with other trading partners continue. Noah Williams is the Julie Plant Granger Professor of Economics at UW-Madison. He's the founding director of the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy. Noah, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Happy to be here.
Well, it can be hard to suss out what numbers mean, which numbers you should look at. These numbers that seem to show bad news, what do you make of these?
Yeah, so there's definitely some worrying signs that we see in the Wisconsin economy. There's a little bit of a mixed picture looking overall, but the general takeaway, looking at many different sources of data, different indicators, is we've definitely seen a slowdown. And even more than that, there are some worrying signs, particularly for manufacturing, as you mentioned. You had alluded to the August numbers. The September ones actually just came out this morning, and they showed an even sharper decline. So year over year, we're looking at, according to that data, 6,800 jobs lost in manufacturing.
And manufacturing is a big part of Wisconsin's economy. As states go, we're pretty manufacturing dependent.
That's right. Yeah, we're roughly twice as manufacturing concentrated as the nation as a whole. It's our largest single industry and accounts for roughly 1 in 5 or 1 in 6 jobs in the state. So it's a prime manufacturer, prime employer.
Before we get into the causes for this, is this a blip or is this maybe a trend?
It's a little too soon to tell. Not to get too technical, but there are kind of two different data sources. One, which is more reliable and talks to essentially gets the data from every single employer that pays into the unemployment insurance system. That data is only available through March, and that data hadn't shown this sharp decline. The smaller survey, which is more frequent, has shown this sharp decline. So we don't quite know if there's something fishy or an anomaly in the statistical data. But certainly, at least we see a slowdown, but perhaps even more than that.
Well, let's get into some potential causes. Your colleague Menzi Chin at UW-Madison has said part of this might be just global demand slowing. The world economy maybe wants less manufactured stuff, including the kinds we make here in Wisconsin. Do you see that as part of the story?
Yeah, I think that's probably the prime component. Looking at Europe, there's certainly been a slowdown, but also in Asia and China in particular, we've seen a slowing in growth, so less demand for our products overseas, certainly.
There's, of course, a lot of attention on trade battles with other countries, tariffs, escalating tariffs, dueling tariffs with, you name it, China, Mexico, Canada, the European Union.
Yes.
Is that something we're feeling here?
Certainly. So China isn't a huge trading partner for Wisconsin. Canada and Mexico are far and away our most important trading partners. So some of the tariffs there have come off with Canada and Mexico. Again, China isn't a primary market for our exports, but we have seen this year roughly 25%, so roughly a quarter of the exports, a decline of roughly 25% in our exports to China. So it's not a huge component, but that component has fallen quite a bit.
Now, if I'm a manufacturer, yes, I'm worried about selling my finished goods to maybe another country and tariffs could hurt me there. Right. I might also be buying raw materials or semi-finished goods from other countries. Is that hurting manufacturers here in the state?
Yeah, so that's perhaps more broadly, that's one of the main sources of difficulty coming from these trade disputes, particularly the aluminum and steel tariffs. So that's raised the cost of inputs on these manufacturers, which has really squeezed their margins and led to less production and less demand for new hiring.
Talking to Noah Williams from UW-Madison, looking at some maybe early warning signs of problems in Wisconsin's manufacturing industry, looking for some more solid recent numbers, but there are some troublesome signs out there. And no, I know people are wondering, you know, eventually another recession will come, maybe next year, maybe in 10 years, who knows? Are signs like this part of a concern that, hey, maybe it's going to be sooner than later?
It's a little too early to say that. I mean, I think looking at the state economy overall and then looking at the national economy, we've certainly seen a growth slowdown. So whereas last year we'd been growing more rapidly nationwide, roughly 3%, this year it slowed to roughly 2% or perhaps less. And that's we've seen similar numbers, but even kind of more extreme in the state. So we've definitely seen a growth slowdown, which makes recessions more likely to happen if we get some more negative shocks. This in itself is probably not enough to generate a recession unless these trade disputes are indeed longer lasting or perhaps become even exacerbated.
I know another concern people in manufacturing and some other sectors have pointed to in Wisconsin is maybe we're not getting new jobs because we don't have the workers of the right age to fill those jobs. Can you tell that part of the story?
Yeah, that's perhaps the most striking feature of the Wisconsin economy is the slow growth of the labor force. The labor force, just the total number of workers either employed or looking for a job, peaked in 2017, and it's actually declined since then. So over the past year, the labor force is down, roughly 10,000 or so since that time. So that comes from the fact that we have an aging population. So we're having fewer births, and we've, over the past decades, have experienced net out-migration, so more people leaving the state than moving in. That's slowed down a little bit, but still we're not getting a whole lot of inflow of workers to the state.
Now, that sounds like a structural problem that's going to be hard for whoever wants to solve it, employers, the state government, you name it, to solve. What kind of tools do we have at our disposal?
So certainly at the state level, there's not a whole lot we can do about the immigration reform. To grow workers, the natural way takes a long time. And certainly looking at school enrollments, this is a problem which is projected to continue for some time. School enrollments are lower than they have been in the past, so we're going to expect fewer workers entering the labor force. So this really is a long-term issue. There have been some moves to kind of bring in populations which were not as engaged in the labor market, whether disabled workers or former prisoners, to bring them back into the labor force to just expand the pool of available workers. And that's something the state has worked on.
These numbers we're talking about are about the number of jobs. Some people pointed toward automation, saying, okay, hey, maybe we're keeping the same levels of productivity or going up in productivity. We just need fewer humans to do that work. Is that part of what's going on here?
So in looking at the long span, and particularly manufacturing, that's the primary cause of the overall decline. So manufacturing employment had declined for a long time before the recession, where it had a very sharp downturn. It's recovered since then, but it's nowhere near where it was in the past, largely because of automation.
All right. I've thrown a bunch of possible causes at you. I probably missed one or two. Anything else that you look at as a possibility that might lead to a decline in manufacturing jobs in the state?
For manufacturing in particular, I think we've touched on most of the main issues. Yeah. Okay.
And people might be listening and thinking, well, wait, how about outsourcing? That was a big part of the story, 80s, 90s. Is that still something we watch for, jobs being moved from, say, a state like Wisconsin to another country or another state, I guess?
I think that trend has slowed down a little bit, and some of the reforms both in the state and nationwide have made Wisconsin and the U.S. a more attractive venue for investment. So that has slowed down. It is still an issue, to be sure.
Right. We've talked to you in the past about a manufacturing jobs credit here in the state. There are debates over its impact. You've written and done studies about this, saying, yeah, net positive.
Yes. So I did a study in early 2017, and then I actually just looked at the data more recently. And the one way, which is common in economics, to look at the impact of a state-level credit is to look at what happens just on either side of the border. So compare a place in southern Wisconsin with northern Illinois and track these over time. And if you look at what happened before the credit was introduced, these counties grew at roughly the same rate. Since the credit was introduced, there was a gap which opened up, and it's been substantial. So since the credit was introduced, counties on the Wisconsin side have grown, manufacturing employment in those counties has grown roughly twice as fast. So it does seem to have had an effect. That gap isn't growing anymore, so perhaps the impact has been already phased in, but it certainly has led to, I would argue, significant manufacturing employment in the state.
In our last minute or so, Noah, what are you watching for next when it comes to manufacturing jobs in the state? What data is out there that we just haven't seen yet?
So the big issue will be when the quarterly data comes out, to see if it does agree with this noisier monthly survey. The other issue which we're looking at are wages, right? So that's the other component of the labor market, which we haven't talked about besides jobs, is the total number or what people are actually being paid. And in a tight labor market, like we've seen, we've expected wages to grow. And Wisconsin had seen growth in wages, but that seems to have tapered off as well. So if we see less wage growth, that would also be a sign of slower labor market activity.
All right. And so a lot of times we have these trailing indicators. We find out how things are 6 months later or
right.
so.
Yes.
All right. Noah, thanks so much for joining us here in the studio again.
Okay. Thank you.
I've been talking to Noah Williams, director of the Center for Research on the Wisconsin Economy and an economics professor at UW-Madison. He was with us today to talk about new preliminary numbers from the Bureau of Labor Statistics that show Wisconsin's manufacturing industry may have lost 5,200 or about 1% of its jobs in August. Are you in manufacturing as an owner of a company or a worker? Love to hear your perspective on this. Email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. It's time to get Halloween costumes together for those who wear costumes. And Google is out with their top 10 lists of the most searched for costumes, this as of September. Number one nationwide, It, as in the movie with the spirit that takes the form of a creepy clown. Clown itself was number six. Witch, Spider-Man, and Dinosaur were numbers 2, 3, and 4. I'm not a big costume guy, but producer Bill Martins is in the studio with me. You get a little more creative.
I've got the creepiest costume of all.
Which is?
So this was shortly after I graduated college and went to a Halloween party as Tropical Storm Bill. So
which
earlier
happened that year.
Earlier that summer, there was a I guess, minor for Tropical Storm standards, and I had this cheap gray sweatshirt with cotton balls glued all over the front of it, sort of like that hurricane symbol, you know, the circle with, like, the fins sticking out of it.
Right.
Somewhere I had a lightning bolt on there, and then across the back, like a jersey, it said Bill.
Uh-huh.
So Tropical Storm Bill.
That makes sense, and that's really on brand for you, because you're a weather nerd. It expresses a side of your personality. And
oh, yeah, right.
Just because you love the weather. And
right,
my
yeah.
costumes express the lazy part of my personality. I'm usually like guy with funny hat on or something, if I go to that level of effort.
People get it, though, right?
Yeah, they get it.
Hey, you're funny hat guy.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I saw on this Google thing, number one costume by city, number one searches. Milwaukee, It, Green Bay, Zombie, Rhinelander, Star Wars, Eau Claire, Spider-Man, Madison had Rabbit. What?
Of course.
Are you going to go as a rabbit this
Why
year?
Why not rabbit? Yeah, done. Yeah.
Okay. We're Team Rabbit here on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network.